As of last year, emerging markets represented nearly 40% of the global economy and close to 15% of the world's stock market. The last decade saw rapid growth in four countries in particular, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, often grouped together and referred to as BRIC. But when the recession hit in 2008, it slowed down this growth. In his new book, Breakout Nations, In Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles, Rishir Sharma, head of emerging markets for Morgan Stanley Investment Management and a columnist for Newsweek and The Wall Street Journal, assesses the meteoric rise of the so-called BRICS and what it means to the West in general and the U.S. in particular. It's published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased to welcome Rishir Sharma to our show today. Hello.
Thank you.
So what distinguishes a breakout nation from an emerging market nation?
Well, I think, you know, just putting this into some context here, that what happened last decade was a truly exceptional story. In fact, there were two big stories of the last decade. One was obviously the big boom bust cycle in the Western world, and you got this credit cycle which went bust. And a lot has been written about that and spoken about that. The second one, which I feel has been sort of recognized but not enough has been discussed about, is this rise of all emerging markets, in that never before did emerging markets see such a spectacular rise as they saw over the past decade. In that every single emerging market last decade enjoyed extraordinary success. And the most spotlight shone on the biggest ones, which are the ones that you mentioned, China, Russia, Brazil, and India.
But you're calling them breakouts as opposed to emerging.
I think that, so like the point I'm making now is that that was last decade's story. The story of this decade is going to be that not every emerging market is going to rise in the way that they rose over the past decade. And you need to distinguish. And breakout nations, the entire concept here is to identify which economies will do much better than what people are expecting them to do. And the problem I have with the BRIC nations, which did well over the past decade, is that the expectations out of them are already too high. So I'm in search of the next sort of economic stories, which will do much better than what people expect and not the last decade's big successes.
Now, do they have to be huge countries? Because South Korea obviously has a booming economy. There are a number of countries that do. But is it just too small to become a member of the BRICS?
No, I think like this, you know, BRIC is a bit of a sort of inflated concept because South Korea is a pretty serious economy. I mean, it has a sort of per capita income of more than $20,000 and its total economic size is $1 trillion. I mean, that's not a small club. There are only 15 economies in the world of that size. I think that a boom is relative. Like South Korea has a per capita income of more than $20,000. America's at $45,000. India is only at $1,500. Now, at a $20,000 economy, if you grow at 4 to 5%, that's a boom. But for a poor economy like India, if they grow at only 4 to 5%, that's a recession. So I think that the term here is very relative in terms of how we define a boom and how we define a downturn.
But in looking over these BRIC countries, they all started in fairly poor shape. So they have a lot of space to grow and still not reach $20,000 for annual income.
Yes, I know. But my entire point of the book is that it's not destined, that all because some country is poor, it's not destined to become rich. And I think this is the sort of myth which got built around last decade. So if you look at the case of Brazil, Brazil's per capita income today is about $12,000. But if you look at the long-term history of Brazil, it's always remained an emerging market and a middle-income country. It's never been able to break out on the upside. It's going to be the next sort of economic star, and it goes through these spells where it does very well for a decade or so. Brazil used to be the China of the world in the 1950s and 1960s. In the 1960s, Brazil's growth rates used to be close to what China's recording today, and then yet after that, its growth rate completely fell apart. So I think the key here is to understand that many emerging markets remain emerging and only very few economic success stories go all the way. Economic development is like a game of snakes and ladders. You go up a bit, you get bitten, you fall down.
How much does their success depend on American and European investment money?
I think a lot, because that is what really pushed up the story a lot over the past decade. The reason we got this extraordinary boom in emerging markets over the past decade was that a lot of cheap money was flowing out of America and Europe into these countries and was reducing their cost of capital. So the fact that the cost of capital was so cheap is one big reason why every single emerging market benefited last decade.
But of course, we've also been hearing about us floating our economy to some degree on Chinese money.
Yeah, I think so. You know, that's there. But I think that that's just the way the global capital, you know, sort of functions today. I mean, I don't think the Chinese are doing anyone a favor. They're doing, you know, what, you know, what they think is the best investment strategy. So in terms of they still see that U.S. Treasury is a very safe investment. So I won't say the Chinese are doing anyone a favor here. This is what they think is their best choice in the world.
Your job is to analyze these markets. You spend a lot of time traveling to do that. But isn't it almost impossible to determine if an emerging market will succeed ultimately?
Yes, I think that's a very, you know, like, fair point. And so therefore, I'm very suspect of all these studies which are very popular today. These, you know, all these popular studies today speak about how China will overtake the U.S. by 2020, and by 2040, India will be the largest economy, and or just after China. Because I think that all these long-term projections, which go out so much into the future, have two fundamental flaws. One, as you point out, it's very difficult to sort of look that much out in the future. And secondly, I think that all these people who make projections in 2030, 2040 is of no relevance to the person today.
And you write in the book, the new rule is to forecast so far into the future that no one will know you got it wrong.
Exactly. You know,
but a perfect example would be Japan, wouldn't it? We were hearing similar predictions about Japan.
Yes.
In through the late 80s into the early 90s. And nobody predicted that it would have the kind of bubble burst that it had.
Yes.
Even though looking back, it becomes quite obvious that we should have seen it.
Yes, I think that Japan and the other sort of country, you know, which we forget is also about the USSR. Some leading U.S. economists used to keep these charts as to when the USSR economy will overtake the American economy. And even I think the CIA in the 1970s believed that was a real prospect. So I think that all these sort of projections are made about the long term, but I take them, you know, like really with a pinch of salt, because you know that these things don't materialize the way people project them to.
So should investors just be thinking short term?
No, I think that, you know, there is a right time frame. And I think that right time frame is about 3 to 5 years. That's what I try and do. So the breakout nations I try and identify in the book are for countries which I think that over the next 3-5 years, maximum a decade, will do well. But the more important thing about the book is the process, which is that I try and identify that what are these rules of the road that as you're traveling that you should be looking out for to figuring out whether a country is on the right path or is going off track. I think to me that is more important rather than even coming up with countries, because I find that those things can change. Like I used to be very bullish on Russia 7 years ago, thinking that they were doing the right things. But I've turned quite wary of Russia in the last couple of years, because I think the reliance on oil has become so much. And I also feel that the leadership out there has become very complacent about the oil wealth.
The same people who looked like they were going to turn the economy around are the ones who now are just relying on oil and gas.
Yes, that's right.
But that worked well for a country like Saudi Arabia. Is Russia just too big for that to work for it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that even Saudi Arabia, I mean, the income inequality there is incredible. And so I don't think, you know, Saudi Arabia has done okay, but it's not an economic success story by any stretch of imagination. In fact, I still remember going to Russia a decade ago, and they would, you know, keep telling me that we are not a Saudi Arabia. We are much better. We are more diversified. We have a much, you know, like a bigger population base and a middle class, which is much healthier. So I think that, you know, most commodity economies, in fact, don't do well over time because they end up relying on just natural resources to pull them through.
Didn't you have a conversation about this with Vladimir Putin?
Yeah, that anecdote is something which I sort of speak about, which is that in late 2010, I was invited to Russia and to give a presentation to Putin about how the sort of economy is doing. And this was televised live out in Moscow. I was not prepared for that. And my presentation was quite blunt about how his policies were good for Russia 10 years ago, but may not be that good for Russia today. And I think that he was quite receptive. He was sitting there and taking notes down, and it was being televised. But I think his sort of media, like the print media, which, you know, which the Kremlin controls a lot, really got after me the next day, you know, with sort of front page about how I'd come to spoil the party and Russia didn't need my money anymore. And so that was the dramatic turn that I speak about in the book.
My guest is Ruchir Sharma. His book, Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. You write about the miracle year of 2003, which in great part allowed for the BRIC nations to succeed the way they did. What happened then?
I think the point that you made out earlier in terms of easy money, that's the point at which the U.S. economy also began to recover, because the Fed had super easy monetary policies. And the U.S. economy started to recover quite strongly, and the consumer was very strong. So exports out of emerging markets boomed into the U.S., and the cost of capital was very cheap. And also because emerging markets had done very poorly in the 1980s and 1990s, their average growth rate was only 3.5%. So some catch-up was also taking place after the poor performance, and the catalyst for that catch-up was easy liquidity and the strong performance of the U.S. economy. So the growth rate of emerging markets doubled from 3.5% to more than 7.5% 2003 onwards.
But the U.S. economy has since gone through its own terrible downturn. And I would assume that there's a link, that
yes.
Globalization links all of us together.
Yes. So I think in the U.S., I mean, like, has gone through a downturn, and these emerging markets now are beginning to feel the effects of the fact that the growth in the developed world isn't that strong. So if you look at the growth rate of Brazil and Russia this year, their growth rates are about 3% or so. And I think that that's a far cry from what you were expecting out of them and where they were growing last decade. Russia's growth rate last decade was 7%, and now it's growing at about maybe 3.5% or so. Brazil's growth rate last year dipped to below 3%. So these economies are facing a slowdown, and today we got data out of China showing that the Chinese economy now is growing at its slowest pace in the last 3 years.
And not just for export, but also domestically.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that people are becoming wealthier in China.
Yeah, I think, you know, like, it's all got to do with the fact that that's the reason why China is bound to slow down. Because as a country gets wealthier, it becomes more middle-aged. Middle-aged people can't sprint as fast as young people. And that's what's coming to China now, which is that it's become a middle-income country. Its per capita income is $6,000. And that's the level at which growth rates naturally slow down.
That's what we saw with Japan as well initially. Japan was where cheap labor was available after World War II. And then when Japan got to a point where people were earning much better salaries, and then they started sending the work out to South Korea and Taiwan and more recently Vietnam.
Very true.
And then those economies start doing well and people start demanding higher wages there.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. So
you got to keep on finding places like Guatemala.
Well, not every country does well, but there's enough out in the pipeline. So I think a Japan parallel is very accurate. Unfortunately, what happens is that when people speak about Japan, they think instantly of the stagnation of the 1990s. Instead, I introduce something there called a middle-income deceleration, which takes place. And in Japan, the economy began to slow down to a lower growth path, still a healthy growth path, but a lower growth path in the 1970s. And that's where I think China is today.
Now, you say that it's a mistake to group all of these countries, the countries we call BRIC, although they all rose around the same time, because they have very different kinds of economies?
Yeah, I think that, as I said, that BRIC came into fashion because all emerging markets did well. And BRIC were the largest of them. So they sort of got the maximum spotlight. But they're very different, as you point out. For example, the richness is very different. Like, India's per capita income is only $1,500. Brazil is $12,000. That's very different. China's in the middle at $6,000. Then Brazil and Russia depend on commodity exports. India likes lower commodity prices because it imports most of its commodities.
But India is also, it seems to me, is trying to develop an economy based more on the Western model.
Yeah.
Kind of a high-tech model. I would think that if I were running one of these economies, I'd be looking to Sweden or Germany and say, how can we do that here? Would it even be possible?
I think, you know, that's a much later stage game because, you know, when your per capita income is very low, at that point in time, you're looking for the low-hanging fruit. As you become richer, then you're looking for the more innovative, cutting-edge stuff. So yes, the countries that you quote are good examples in terms of for richer countries to do well. And why I'm bullish on South Korea is because I think it's the Germany of Asia.
My guest is Ruchir Sharma, R-U-C-H-I-R-S-H-A-R-M-A. He is the head of emerging markets for Morgan Stanley Investment Management, columnist for Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal, and the author of a new book called Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. It's published by W.W. Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Ruchir Sharma. His book, Breakout Nations, in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles, published by Norton. So we talked about how the BRIC nations all suddenly did very well during the economic boom of 2003. Were there similarities in the strategies among these countries despite their political and economic differences?
No, I think that they all benefited, as I said, from, you know, from cheaper money, from the fact that the Western sort of economies were doing well, and the fact that China, you know, was sort of growing so quickly, and China's commodity demand was what was really attracting a lot of sort of capital and very strong export growth to other emerging markets.
Two of these countries we might call real democracies, but yeah. The other three are varying degrees of autocratic states. Does the political leadership, or does that aspect of the country play a role in all of this?
No, in fact, I look into that like aspect, and the conclusion I make is that it's exactly 50-50. That if you look at the history of countries which have done well, and especially over the past three decades, whether you're a democratic or an authoritarian regime has no effect on your economic performance. So for every success story like China, which is a command and control economy, you have a Vietnam, which is not doing that well, even though it's a command and control economy. And for every democracy that does well, there's one democracy that doesn't do well. So it's purely about the quality of leadership and the political leaders and not about the system.
And I was going to ask you, how does that apply to countries like Greece and Spain, which are moving in the opposite direction? Was it just simply the quality of political leadership, or was it the fact that there were certain entrenched cultural aspects to their economy that were really hard to get past?
No, I think, you know, Greece and Spain, what they went through was a classic boom-bust cycle. I don't think it had like anything to do with the political leadership, in that Greece and Spain like accumulated a lot of debt after they adopted a common currency, and the cost of capital became very low. So I think that that's the reason why they had this boom-bust cycle after they adopted a common currency. And they had a very good time, in fact, in terms of Spain's growth rate over the until the 2007 crisis was very strong, and even Greece did reasonably well. The problem is that the growth was debt-fueled, and that's why like it went down. Having said that, they're still sort of success stories from a very long-term standpoint, that they're much richer than many poorer countries. But the fundamental problem which distorted their economic success there is the fact that they had a common currency tied to the euro, and that reduced their cost of capital to very low levels, artificially low levels, attracting wrong kinds of investment.
Getting back to the whole business of democracies, the conventional wisdom has always been that democracies will fare better. And predictions were that China would become more democratic as its economy has grown. Of course, that hasn't happened. How much can we actually predict about these sorts of things?
No, I think that you're correct. You cannot predict. So, I've done a study in the book which looks at whether democracies or authoritarian regimes are better for economic growth. And I come to the conclusion it is exactly 50-50, that you cannot say that because a country has an X political system, it's going to function better.
But the feeling is that as the economy grows, the country's politics has to open up simply because there's more involvement with other countries.
And yes, that may be true, but we saw in the case of Korea, Taiwan, et cetera, that it took a long time for that to happen. So it's not a foregone conclusion that needs to happen.
You mentioned earlier that China's economy is slowing down. Mm-hmm. What factors are contributing to that?
Well, the fact that it's middle-aged or middle-income. As I said, that once you're a middle-income country and middle-aged, it's hard to grow that fast. So if you look at some of the big drivers of China's growth over the past decade, very strong export growth, huge amount of investment growth, and its demographics, they're all beginning to sort of turn for the or slow down. So they're not such a powerful driver of growth as they used to be.
Well, we had all these people coming from the countryside into the big cities along the coast. That slowed down?
Well, that's showing signs now of slowing down naturally because for the first time, and this is a very important statistic, for the first time, China today has more people in its urban areas than in rural areas. So, you know, like it, my entire point is that this begins to slow down. So you're completely correct that when people are moving from the farmlands to urban areas, that's a very powerful driver of growth. But that begins to slow down if you already have people living in urban areas. And China's urbanization rate now is around 50%.
And you say that's led to an inflated real estate market.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's in terms of, that's also got to do with the fact that the cost of money is very cheap out there. And so, in fact, there's a lot of sort of like property price speculation. And it's the number one factor that the Chinese government is trying to calm down just now, that the prices of homes in China, relative to their underlying incomes, are more expensive than what the U.S. ever saw, even in 2007.
As somebody who is an investment analyst, do you only look at the big issues, or do you factor in things like the recent scandal involving the politically powerful couple Bo Xilai and his wife Gu Kailai?
Well, I think it's very difficult to get a reading of the situation because the system's so opaque. So as a fundamental investor and an analyst, as you call me, I look at all sorts of factors. You know, when you're trying to see if a country will do well or will not do well, it's an art and not a science. You have to sort of look at a combination of factors. So it goes somewhere in the calculation. And what I try and do in the book also is come up with these rules of the road, that as I travel to these emerging markets, what is it that I'm looking at to like figure out whether it'll succeed or it'll fail? And I guess politics is one of them, but there is no magic bullet that this is one factor which is a make or break for a country.
My guest is Rishir Sharma. His book, Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracle, is published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What about demographics? Two of the biggest of these countries are not homogeneous cultures, India and China. Many languages spoken within them, different racial and ethnic groups. Does that enrich the situation or does that hinder it?
Well, I think that China is much more homogeneous than India. So I remember speaking to this Korean CEO who was, you know, trying to set up businesses in both the countries. And he told me something very interesting. He says, when I go to China, I find the market is much more uniform. And when people tell me, let's go to India, I say where? Because the market is so heterogeneous. So China is much more homogeneous compared to India.
Even though people speak different dialects that are totally...
Yeah. But in terms of their, you know, their sort of habits and their sort of thing is much more homogeneous compared to India. India is all over the map in that like India is more like a collection of states. You know, so Churchill had this sort of line about India that India is more a geographical term than a country. So I think India is much more sort of heterogeneous and very diverse compared to China.
What about a country like Brazil, which is also huge?
Yeah, I think in all these countries, that's the case. But of all the countries I visit, I don't see the differences as much on a statewide basis as I see in a country like India.
In India, you write, businesses are now looking to expand abroad.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the rules of the road that I come up with, that which is that when businesses look to expand abroad, we initially celebrate it because it means that they're getting more competitive. But when that's all that they're looking to do, it's a problem. It tells you that they're not that happy with the domestic operating environment. And that's something we saw in South Africa and Mexico in particular, where more than 50% of the profits of companies in those markets come from abroad rather than the domestic market. And my point is that in India, the companies, it's a bad sign if the companies within India want to invest too much abroad, because they should be looking to tap the domestic consumer market because that has such big potential. But obviously, they're finding too many roadblocks in being able to do that.
But they also, in some cases, ship their workers abroad. We've seen that with China. And just today in the New York Times, there's the Infosys scandal, which involves people being sent from India to this country to work for this Indian company and violating their visas, according to one whistleblower's claims.
Yeah, but I think that's a very small incident.
Infosys is a big country, company.
Yes, I know, but I'm not sure like about the details of this case. And I think that, like, it's still being sort of investigated, as you know. But I think the whole point is that this is not organized, you know, in terms of there will be such cases, but it's not as if it's some strategy of the government or of Indian people like to do this. I think it's a very sort of, you know, like isolated kind of event that tends to happen.
In your chapter on Brazil called Is God Brazilian, you write, a rule of the road, if the local prices in an emerging market country feel expensive even to a visitor from a rich country, that country is probably not a breakout nation.
Yes, I think.
Well, that would be Brazil and Russia, wouldn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. You know, so like one of those new things that I've tried to put in the book is something called a Four Seasons Index, which is that as a business traveler, when you travel to various emerging markets and you get to stay at some of the best hotels, just the hotel rates tell you whether a country is cheap or expensive for doing business. And the two countries which show up on a global basis, even if you look at the U.S., as the most expensive countries to get a hotel room in, especially at the high end, are Brazil and Russia. So that tells you the currencies are very uncompetitive. They're very expensive. On the other hand, if you go to places in Asia, such as Thailand, Indonesia, or the Philippines, they all have the Four Seasons hotels, and you can get a room rate there for a fifth or a fourth of the price at what you can get in Brazil or Russia.
And why are the prices so high in Brazil and Russia?
Because of the commodity boom, that there's been a lot of money which has gone in there in chasing commodities. And that has inflated the exchange rate a lot. And that's a real problem for the competitiveness of the other countries. Of the other sort of sectors in the economy.
When we look at emerging markets, you say we should also look at the turnover rate of the country's billionaires. What's a healthy turnover rate?
Now, you know, I think that the whole point here is if you look at the billionaires index, and I think that what you want to see there is that this process of creative destruction, that new wealth is being created. If you have the same billionaires who keep showing up every year, you know, like after another.
As they do in this country?
Well, I think here the churn is much more. Yes, you know, some of the big billionaires are, you know, have been around for a while, but the churn is much more. But in some of these countries, the churn tends to be very low. That the same companies which existed, you know, 10 years ago or the same billionaires exist today. I mean, there'll be some who'll be holdovers, but you need an active churn. And the second point is, it's very important how the wealth is being created. If that wealth is being created because of genuine manufacturing or technology, that's a good sign. But the billionaires are all creating their wealth, as they are like in Russia or pockets of India or Malaysia, because they have access to commodities and good government connections, that's not a good sign, because that sort of shows it's an exclusive society and not something which is broad-based.
Mexico is another example,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes. So Mexico, Malaysia, and Russia in particular show up at the top of this billionaires index that I've created. And in Russia, here's the real odd point. Russia has the second highest number of billionaires in the world after the U.S., even though its economy is nowhere near as big as U.S. or China. And yet, if you look at the number of millionaires in Russia, they don't even feature in the top 15. So you got this incredible wealth at the top of a whole number of billionaires, but the number of millionaires in Russia aren't even in the top 15 of the global rankings.
So is Putin aware of all of this? You talked to him about this.
Yeah, I think he's aware, but I think that the system there has.
Well, he's part of the problem. He's skimming an awful lot of money himself.
Well, I think that, you know, what I mentioned about Putin is that he was that like any leader, they tend to outrun their usefulness after time. So Putin had a very good stint for the first 6-7 years. He did what I thought was right for Russia of bringing stability and law and order. But like any leader across the world, and we saw this even with the best, like Margaret Thatcher and even the Mitterrands, that after they stay in office for too long, they tend to then sort of, you know, lose touch with the people and are more involved in protecting their interests rather than growing the pie.
And develop what some people call a kleptocracy.
Yeah.
A country like Nigeria, for example, which has this very rich culture, a lot of brilliant people, and yet and a lot of natural wealth cannot seem to emerge simply because it's always been run by a kleptocracy.
Yes, very true. But I'm a bit more optimistic on Nigeria now compared to even in Russia, because I think that Nigeria now has a new leader who is trying to reform the country. And I think that the other point about Nigeria is that it's sort of, you know, trying to sort of build other industries as well. So I think that you're right, that that's been Nigeria's historical problem and why it's a market which has always remained poor, but it's showing some signs now of being on the mend.
What about some of the other countries you talk about? Poland, the Czech Republic, Romania?
Yeah.
Romania?
Well, I think that Romania may have a chance. I don't identify it as a clear breakout nation. I think Poland, I do. I think Poland is a very solid economy. These days, when we speak about Europe, we only think about boom-bust cycles and debt crises. I think that Poland is a very solid economy, doesn't have too much of a debt problem. Its growth rate is quite solid at 4%, and it has a sizable middle class. And the institutions of that country are very well run because they have, you know, sort of been adopting European institutional standards over the past few years. And even Czech has similar traits and has done very well over the past decade or so. But I think Romania is too early to say that. It's quite poor. And I just throw that out there, that if Romania can, you know, follow the example of their richer neighbors such as Poland and Czech, maybe even they can become one day a breakout nation.
If I were to look over your record over the past 10 years, how many times are you willing to admit you were wrong?
All the time. Because I think that, you know, that's the whole point, that in this game, you have to try and sort of, you know, beat the odds. And it's a probability game.
Well, where would you have invested in that you now think would have been a big mistake?
Well, I think that, there are lots of ways that we sort of, go wrong or are too early on something and too wrong on something. Like I thought, like, for example, in South Africa, I was much more optimistic on South Africa's prospects than how South Africa has done over the past few years. And similarly, like on Russia, it took me the crisis of 2008 to wake up and understand all the weaknesses in Russia. So I think that those are kind of mistakes where you learn late about the problems underlying those economies.
Now, if you were back home in India and you were looking at the United States, what would you be predicting?
I think, the book ends on a pretty optimistic note on the United States, saying that the United States has one big benefit, which is low expectations, unlike India. So in that, after the financial crisis of 2008-2009, we all thought that the United States was going to go the Japanese way of stagnation. And what the U.S. is doing now is that it's growing at not a robust pace, but at a much healthier pace than what people thought. The people thought that the growth rate of the U.S. may be as low as 1%, like that of Japan. We're growing at 2.5%. And there are two or three reasons for that. One, that the dollar is very competitive. It's a very competitive exchange rate just now in the U.S. It's very cheap. Two, that because wage growth in the U.S. has been restrained compared to China, where it's really been sort of exploding, the gap is closing. And so we're seeing some sort of a manufacturing renaissance take place in the U.S. And third is technology. The one lead that the U.S. has maintained and continues to build over is technology. That more than one-third of global spending on R&D is done in the U.S. And that's the reason why the U.S. is still able to produce the killer applications. And whether it's cloud computing or the best mobile phones or got to do with iPads, they all seem to come out of the U.S. And that's a very important point.
And have you spoken to the Republican candidates about this?
Well, I think that, in the midst of a political campaign, you know, like all sorts of statements are made, and I'm not sure that it's like recognized. But I think that this is a testament to the vibrancy and the health of the private sector in the U.S., that it's done so that it's being able to sort of emerge from this crisis in its own gentle way. Now, this is not to say the U.S. has no problems. The debt problem in the U.S. is an extremely serious problem, and we could trip over that again at the end of this year with the debt ceiling being hit. But I think that the change at the margin is positive in the U.S. because of these three factors that I outlined.
Do any of the BRIC countries you write about have serious debt problems?
Well, China, ironically, that a lot of people don't realize that China's total debt as a share of its economy is quite high for a country with a per capita income of only $6,000. So I think China in particular has a debt problem. And so does India as far as its government debt's concerned, that India's government debt as a share of its GDP is about 65% or so. And that's quite high for a poor economy such as India.
So you say that the BRICS are not really all in great shape, but should we add an S for South Korea to the end of it?
Well, I think the S was meant for South Africa, and I think that's not true. I just feel this acronym sort of thing is a nice marketing tool and a nice marketing gimmick, but we need to sort of get a bit more real. Then why just talk about these economies? Let's talk about all breakout nations.
Rishir Sharma's book, Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles, is published by Norton. And I want to thank you so much for being on our show today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.